Mein Kampf, Volume 1, An Accounting. Chapter 1, Childhood Home. Today, I am pleased that fate chose the city of Braunau on the Inn of Northern Austria as my birthplace. This little town is on the frontier of the two German states whose reunion, at least for those of us from the younger generation, will be the accomplishment of a lifetime. We must do everything we can to reunite these states. Austria must return to the great German mother country. Not for economic reasons. No, the economics are unimportant. Even if it did not make economic sense, it must still take place because common blood belongs in one common realm. The German people have no moral right to set up remote colonies when they cannot even unite their own children in a common state. The people will only earn the right to acquire foreign soil when the Reich has expanded to include every German. The plow will become the sword, and the wheat which becomes the bread of posterity will be watered by the tears of war. This little frontier city has now become the symbol of a great undertaking, but it also has a past that we should take as a warning today. More than 100 years ago, this humble place had the privilege of being immortalized in German history as the scene of a tragedy which shook the whole German nation. It was the day of our fatherland's deepest humiliation when the bookseller Johannes Palm, a citizen of Nuremberg, an unapologetic nationalist and hater of France, died for the Germany which he loves passionately even in his time of misfortune. Johannes Philipp Palm was a book dealer in Nuremberg and in 1806 sold a pamphlet denouncing France titled Germany's Deepest Humiliation, but France previously invaded and was in control of Bavaria at the time. The Bavarian police chief turned him in, he refused to name the author, and Napoleon ordered Palm to be shot at Braunau on the Inn, where Hitler was later born, and where there is a monument to Palm. That was all parenthetical. Palm stubbornly refused to reveal the names of his fellows who believed as he did. He was very much like our Leo Schleier. He fought in the First World War, joined the Nazi Party in 1922, and committed acts of sabotage against the French occupation of the Ruhr, and was betrayed, tried, and executed by the French. He was viewed as a hero in the Nazi Party. That was also parenthetical. And, like Schlargater, Palm was betrayed to France by a government representative. An Augsburg police director was responsible, and this act laid down the framework that formed the modern disreputable official German government under the Reich of Mr. Severing. Karl Wilhelm Severing was a social democrat, official in the Weimar government, controlling Germany at the time, who refused to make an effort to stop the execution of Schlageter. More parentheticals. This little city on the Inn, which was made golden as a result of the German martyrdom I mentioned, was German-Bavarian by blood and Austrian only by borders. It is here my parents lived in the late 1880s. My father, a conscientious employee of the state as a customs official, and my mother, occupied with the household, were both, above all, devoted to us children with unwavering love and care. I do not remember much from that period. After only a few years, my father left the little frontier town he was so fond of, so he could take a new post at Passau in Germany itself. In those days, Austrian customs officials traveled frequently. Soon afterward, my father went to Linz, where he retired from work. This does not mean the old gentleman had a chance to rest. His family could be called very poor farmers, and, even in his earliest days, he had not lived in a happy home. Before he turned 13, the small boy packed his knapsack and ran away from his home in the mountainous section of Lower Austria. Against the advice of villagers, he chose to go to Vienna and learn a trade. This was back in the 1850s, so it was not a simple decision to travel into the unknown with only 3 crown coins. But by the time the 13-year-old turned 17, he had passed his journeyman's examination to be a cobbler, yet he had still not found contentment. To the contrary, the long period of economic problems back then, the unending misery and wretchedness he encountered only strengthened his determination to give up his trade and become something better. When he was a poor boy in the village, he thought that the church pastor embodied the highest possible summit of a human aspiration. However, his experience in the big city replaced this notion with the dignified possibility of becoming a state official. With the endurance of a man who had grown old through grief and distress while still half a child, the 17-year-old mustered up his new determination and became a customs official. When he was almost 23, I believe, he decided that he had achieved the goal he had set long ago. The poor boy had once taken a vow not to return to his native village until he had become somebody. He had reached his goal, but when he returned, no one in the village remembered the boy of years earlier. As he looked around, he found the village had grown strange to him. It was no longer the village he remembered from childhood. When he finally retired at 56, he could not stand to live a single day as a do-nothing, so he bought property in the neighborhood of the Upper Austrian market town of Lambach, farmed it, and thus completed the circle of a long and hard-working life by returning to the point where his forefathers began. I believe it was around this time that my first ideals were forming. My constant romping around outdoors, taking the long road to school, and my association with extremely rowdy boys sometimes gravely worried my mother. It also kept me from being a stay-at-home soul. So, the few serious ideas I had about my future certainly did not point toward my father's career. Even then, my gift for speaking was developing more or less through violent disputes with my playmates. I had somehow become a little ringleader among my group, little Hitler. I had no trouble learning and completing my lessons at school, but otherwise I was fairly hard to handle. In my free time, I had singing lessons at the Catholic Monastery's chapter in Lambach, and here I was dazzled by the dignified and magnificent church music festivals. Just as my father had once looked upon the little village pastor, I now looked at the local religious leader as an ideal to aspire to. At least for a while this was the case. My father did not think very highly of his quarrelsome boy's vocal talents, and he did not see a future in the church for his offspring. He had no appreciation for such youthful ideas either. He must have watched anxiously as my nature clashed with my desires. My desire for that calling soon disappeared and was replaced with hopes that I were better suited to my temperament. In rummaging through my father's library, I found various military books. There was a popular edition of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. 2 volumes of an illustrated magazine from those years now became my favorite reading. It was not long before the great heroic battle had become my greatest spiritual experience. From then on, I became more and more enthusiastic over anything connected with war, or at least with being a soldier. This was important to me for another reason. For the first time, I was forced to ask myself if there was a difference between the Germans who fought these battles and the Germans around me, and if they were different, how were they different? Why did Austria not fight in the war? Why did my father and all the others in our city not fight? Were we not like all the other Germans? Did we not all belong together? This problem stirred in my young brain for the first time. I learned that not every German was fortunate enough to belong to the Empire of Bismarck. I could not understand this at the time, so I began my studies. Based on my character, and especially my temperament, my father decided that attending a classical secondary school, gymnasium high school attended from age 10 to 18, which teaches in Greek or Latin classics, but not vocational subjects, parenthetical. Would conflict with my personality. He thought a vocational school would be more suitable. His opinion was confirmed by my obvious ability to draw. That was a subject which he believed was neglected in the Austrian humanistic schools. Perhaps his own hard-working life made him think less of classical studies, which he considered impractical. Being a man of principle, he had already decided that his son should, no, must, become a state employee. His own difficult youth naturally made his later accomplishments seem even greater because they were the product of his own iron strength and ability. The pride of being a self-made man led him to want the same or better for his son. He believed his own hard work could make it easier for his child to succeed in the same field. My outright refusal to follow a career that had been his whole life was, to him, quite inconceivable. So my father's decision was simple, definite, and clear, and, in his eyes, he had an obvious course of action. His lifetime struggle for existence had made him domineering, and he would have never left an important decision to a boy he saw as inexperienced. This would have seemed an unforgivable weakness in the eyes, or in the exercise of his parental authority over his child's future. It was impossible for him to reconcile it with his concept of duty, and yet it was all destined to end quite differently. At the time, I was barely 11, and for the first time in my life, I was forced to oppose my father. Steadfast and determined as my father might be in carrying out the plans that were fixed in his mind, his son was no less stubborn and resistant in refusing this unappealing idea. I would not enter the civil service. Neither pleading nor reasoning with me had an effect on my resistance. I would not be an official. No, and again, no. Every attempt to arouse my interest in that calling through descriptions of my father's experience had quite the opposite effect. I yawned myself sick at the thought of sitting in a government office, not being the master of my own life, but a slave, devoting my entire existence to filling out various forms. What effect could this possibly have on a young boy who was anything but, quote, good in the ordinary sense? I did my schoolwork with ridiculous ease, and had so much free time left that I was outdoors more than in. Today, when my political opponents scrutinize my life with such loving care, searching back into my childhood for the satisfaction of uncovering some piece of deviltry this fellow Hitler was up to in his youth, I thank heaven for them giving me a few more memories of that happy time. Field and forest were the battleground where my constantly recurring differences in opinion were settled. Even the attendance at the secondary school which followed did little to restrain me. But now another dispute had to be fought out. So long as my father's intention was to make me into an official clashed only with my general dislike of the career itself, the conflict was quite tolerable. I could withhold my private views, and I did not have to make a constant issue of them. My own determination never to become an official was enough to give me an inner calm. I clung to this determination firmly. The situation became more difficult when I developed a plan of my own that opposed my father. This happened when I was still only 12. I cannot recall how it happened, but one day it was clear to me that I would be a painter, an artist. My talent for drawing had been clearly demonstrated, and in fact, it was one of my father's reasons for sending me to a secondary school. However, he would never consider giving me professional art training. On the contrary, when I rejected my father's pet idea once again, he asked me for the first time what I myself wanted to be. Without thinking, my decision suddenly popped out. It was clear my choice had already been firmly planted and would not be changed, and for a moment my father was speechless. A painter? An artist? He doubted my sanity, and then thought perhaps that he had not understood correctly. But when I explained it to him, and he saw I was serious, he was against it completely. Any talents I might have were simply beyond his consideration. An artist! Never, not so long as I live. But since his son had inherited, among various other qualities, a stubbornness like his own, my answer was equally stubborn. Both sides stuck to their guns. My father held to his never, and I redoubled my nevertheless. The result was not pleasant. The old gentleman was embittered, and though I loved him, I was equally bitter. My father forbade me even to hope that I would study painting. I went a step further and declared that in that case I would not learn anything more. Of course, I came in second with such a declaration, since the old gentleman began to ruthlessly assert his authority. I then learned to keep silent in the future, but I did carry out my threat. I hoped that when my father saw my lack of progress in school, he would have to let me pursue the happiness I dreamed of. I did not know whether my calculation would have been correct or not. The only certainty was my obvious failure in school. Anything else I learned was something I thought I would use later as a painter. Whatever I thought was not connecting to painting, or whatever failed to interest me, I sabotaged. My report cards from that point on were always in extremes. Next to good and excellent rankings were passing and below passing. By far, my best performances were in geography and particularly in world history. Those were my two favorite subjects. When I look back now, so many years later, I see two facts that are especially significant. First, I became a nationalist. Second, I learned to understand the meaning of history. Old Austria was a national state that consisted of many states. At that time, someone who was a subject of the German Reich could not grasp what this fact meant to their daily life. After the Great March of Triumph by the Army of Heroes in the Franco-Prussian War, the Germans of the Reich had gradually become separated from German elements elsewhere. They did not understand the value, or they were no longer aware of the value in it. The German Austrians were too easily confused, and as a result, the imperial dynasty decayed along with the otherwise sound and healthy people. They did not understand that if the Germans had not been of the best blood, they would never have had the ability to impress their character on a state of 52 million Austrians. The mistaken idea took root, especially in Germany, that Austria was a German state. This was nonsense, and the result had grave consequences, but it was still a brilliant tribute to the 10 million Germans in Ostmark, the Eastmark or Eastern Borderlands. Austria, because their small presence was perceived as a total ownership by distant Germans. Very few in the German Reich realized there was a constant struggle to preserve the German language, German schools, and German character in Austria. Today, the sad state of affairs has been forced upon millions of our people who dream of a common fatherland while they sit under a foreign thumb and long to preserve the sacred mother tongue. Finally, people are beginning to realize what it means to fight for one's nationality. And now, perhaps, a few here and there can appreciate the greatness of the German population in Ostmark, which through its own resources shielded the Reich on the east for centuries, then waged an exhausting guerrilla war to maintain the German language frontier in an age when the Reich cared for colonies, but not for its own flesh and blood. As in any battle, there are three groups in the struggle for our language in old Austria: the fighters, the lukewarm, and the traitors. The sorting process begins in school. The most remarkable thing about a language battle is that its waves beat hardest upon the schools. The war is waged over the next generation, and the first war cry is to the children. German boy, do not forget that you are a German. And German girl, remember that you are to be a German mother. Anyone who understands the soul of youth will realize that young people will receive this battle cry with joy. In a hundred ways, they carry on the struggle in their own fashion and with their own weapons. They refuse to sing non-German songs. They are more enthusiastic over German heroes. The more they are suppressed, the more they go hungry in order to save pennies for the war chest of their elders. They have an incredibly sensitive ear for a non-German teacher. They wear the forbidden badges of their own nation and are happy to be punished for it. In other words, they are a faithful image in miniature of their elders, except that their devotion is often stronger and more direct. When I was small, I too shared in the struggle for German nationality in old Austria. Money was collected for the South Mark German League by school associations. We wore the cornflowers and black, red, gold badges proclaiming our beliefs. Cornflowers were the symbol of Germans loyal to the Hohenzollern monarchy and of Austrians who supported the pan-German movement. Parenthetical. Heil was our greeting, and instead of the imperial anthem, we would sing the German anthem, Germany above all, the song of Germany, Deutschland über alles. Despite threats of punishment, young people were politically trained at a time when citizens of a so-called national state still knew very little about their own national character other than their language. I was not among the lukewarm, even in those days. I was soon a fanatical German nationalist. Of course, I do not refer to the present political party using that name. My nationalistic development was very rapid. By the time I was 15, I could easily see the difference between the patriotism shown by those who followed rulers in the imperial dynasty and the true nationalism for the nation and for the people. For me, only nationalism existed. Anyone who has not bothered to study the Habsburg monarchy, Austrian royal family, may find this strong nationalism puzzling. In Austrian schools, there is very little actual Austrian history worth mentioning. The fate of Austria is so completely intertwined in the Germanic life that it is unthinkable to separate history into German and Austrian. When Germany finally split into two spheres of authority, this very separation was German history. The insignia of former German imperial splendor, displayed for all to see in Vienna, continued its spell as a reminder of our common and unending life together. The cry of the German people in Austria for a reunion with their German mother country when the Habsburg state collapsed resulted from a deep acne ache that slept in people's hearts. They had never forgotten this longing to return to the home of their fathers. This can only be explained through the history taught to German Austrians, which made those nationalistic feelings grow. Their history is a fountain that never runs dry, a silent reminder in times when it is easy to forget. Though we may be distracted by momentary prosperity, we hear the whispers of a new future by remembering the past. It is true that the quality of world history education in intermediate schools is in a sad state. Few teachers realize that to memorize and rattle off historical dates and events is not a true history. It is not important for a boy to know exactly when some battle was fought, some general born, or when some insignificant monarch was crowned. No, God knows, that is certainly not what is important. To truly learn history means to open your eyes and discover the forces that cause historical events to happen. The art of reading and of learning means remembering the important facts and forgetting the unimportant. It is likely that my later life was influenced by the fact that I had a good history teacher. He had a unique ability to teach us and test us on principles, not dates. My professor, Dr. Leopold Potsch of the Linz School, was the very embodiment of this idea. He was an older gentleman. He was kind, but set in his manner. His brilliant eloquence not only fascinated us, but absolutely carried us away. I am still touched when I think of this gray-haired man, whose fiery descriptions often made us forget the present, as he conjured us back into days long past, and how he would take dry historical memories from the midst of centuries and transform them into living experiences. In his class, we were often red-hot with enthusiasm, sometimes even moved to tears. No homo. I was luckier than most because this teacher not only illuminated the past by the light of the present, but he taught me to draw conclusions from the present from the past, or draw conclusions for the present from the past. More than anyone else, he gave us an understanding of the current problems. He used our national fanaticism to educate us. He would appeal to our sense of national honor, which brought us bad-mannered adolescents to order more quickly than anything else ever could. This teacher made history my favorite subject. Even then, though he did not intend it, I became a young revolutionary. Indeed, who could possibly study German history under such a teacher without becoming an enemy of a state whose ruling house had such a catastrophic influence on the nation? Who could preserve his allegiance to the emperors of a dynasty that had betrayed the interests of the German people again and again for its own petty advantage? Did we not know, even as boys, that this Austrian state had no love for us as Germans, and indeed it could have none? My historical insight into the work of the Austrian Habsburg monarchy was strengthened by my daily experience. In the north and in the south, foreign people came in and poisoned the body of our nation. Even Vienna became less and less a German city. The House of the Archdukes showed favoritism to the Czechs at every opportunity. It was the hand of the goddess of eternal justice and retribution that overthrew the deadliest enemy of Austria's German nature when she struck Archduke Francis Ferdinand by the very bullets he had helped to cast. After all, he was the patron who was charged to protect Austria from the northern Slavs. The burdens laid on the German people were enormous. They suffered unheard-of sacrifices in taxes and blood. Anyone who was not blind could see their sacrifice would be in vain. What hurt us most was the fact that these activities were shielded by the alliance with Germany. The gradual extermination of German qualities in the old monarchy was to a certain extent sanctioned by Germany itself. The hypocrisy was evident when the Habsburg monarchy worked hard to give the outside world the impression that Austria was still a German state. And this only fanned hatred for that monarchy into blazing anger and contempt within Austria. In Germany, the elected members of the government failed to see any of this happening. It was like they were struck with blindness. They could have walked beside a corpse showing signs of decay and proclaimed they had discovered signs of new life. In the alliance between the young German Empire and the Austrian sham state grew the seeds of the First World War and of the collapse. Throughout this book, I will more thoroughly detail the problem of this alliance. It will be sufficient now to say that as a boy, I arrived at an insight which never left me, but only grew deeper. This insight was that the safety of German culture in Austria first required the destruction of Austria, and that feelings of nationalism have nothing to do with patriotism to an imperial dynasty. The House of Habsburg was destined to bring misery on the German nation. Even then, this realization created a warm love for my German-Austrian homeland and a profound hatred for the Austrian state. I never abandoned how I learned to think about history either. World history became my inexhaustible source for understanding how the present events, that is to say the political situation, came to be. I did not intend to learn from history. Instead, history was to teach me. If I became a political revolutionary so quickly, then I also became a revolutionary in the arts equally fast. The upper Austrian capital had an excellent theater, which put on nearly everything. When I was 12, I saw the heroic William Tell play for the first time. A few months later, I saw my first opera, Lohengrin, a Wagner opera about knights. I was totally captivated. My youthful enthusiasm for the master of Bayreuth, meaning the composer, Wagner, Bayreuth, is where he lived until he died, knew no bounds. Again and again, I was drawn to his works, and it seems fortunate to me now that I could attend the smaller performances where I could get up close, and it actually intensified the experience. Once my painful adolescent years were over, my deep aversion to the calling my father had chosen for me was even clearer. I knew that I could never be happy as a civil servant. My talent for drawing had been recognized at school, and my determination to be an artist was firmly fixed. Neither prayers nor threats dissuaded me. I was going to be a painter, and I would not be an official for anything in the world. It was curious that, as I grew older, I took an increasing interest in architecture, too. At the time, I thought it complemented my painting ability, and was pleased that my artistic interests had expanded. I never dreamed that it would all turn out quite differently. My calling was to be decided sooner than I could have expected. When I was 13, I lost my father suddenly. A stroke took the vigorous old gentleman, painlessly terminating his earthly career and plunging us all into the deepest of grief. His deep desire to give his child a livelihood and spare his offspring from his own bitter struggle must have seemed unfulfilled, but he had sown the seeds for a future which neither he nor I could have understood then. There was no outward change yet. My mother continued my education according to my father's wishes, intending that I prepare for a civil service position eventually, while I myself was more determined than ever to avoid becoming an official. I became less and less interested in school and grew more indifferent. Suddenly, an illness came to my assistance. Within a few weeks, my future, and the subject which caused constant dispute at home, was decided for us. I had serious lung trouble, and the doctor urgently advised my mother against putting me into a closed office environment. My attendance at the secondary school was also interrupted for at least a year. What I had secretly desired for so long, what I had always fought for, had now, through this illness, become a reality almost of its own choosing. Pressured by my illness, my mother finally agreed to let me go to the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna, instead of the vocational and secondary school. The happy days I expected to follow seemed to me almost like a beautiful dream, and a dream they were to remain. 2 years later, my mother's death put a sudden end to all my fine plans. She died at the end of a long, painful illness which had little room for hope of recovery. Even so, the blow to me was terrible. I had honored my father, but I had loved my mother. I was forced by need and hard reality to make a quick decision. My father was a man of small means, and what he had saved was largely used up by my mother's grave illness. My orphan's pension was not nearly enough to live on. I was compelled to earn my own bread somehow. With a bag of clothes in my hand and an inexhaustible will in my heart, I set off for Vienna. What my father had accomplished 50 years before, I hoped to also wrestle from fate. I, too, would become something important, but never an official.